Objective field theory, which is maybe a little too close to home. I may be regretting the choice of the slide now, but we'll move on. All right, so this is the outline of the talk. So first of all, I understand that this is in part a particle physics audience, so I'm going to take a moment to try and describe super radiance, and especially in this talk, what I want to talk about in particular is what's known as rotational super radiance. Then I'm going to try and mention, which is probably more towards your interest, why this is an important phenomenon to understand now, as opposed to in the 70s. I want to build an effective field theory for spinning objects. And by spinning objects, I don't mean things with half integer spins like electrons, but I mean like proper classical rotating objects like, you know, a star or something like that. And in order to do this, I'm going to first have to review the formalism for spontaneous symmetry breaking in the presence of space-time symmetries. In the presence of space-time symmetries, and a little bit of the coset construction. And then from there, I'll finally be able to use these effective field theory techniques to describe super radiance. And in particular, I'm going to touch on, hopefully if I have time, how to discuss bound states, which are particularly interesting for why we should be thinking about this now. And, you know, ideally some grand words about beyond standard model physics and LIGO, things like that. Okay. So first of all, what is rotational super radiance? So for relativists, rotational super radiance, or just super radiance for short in that community, is a very almost magical phenomena that happens because Kerr black holes are really incredible. You look at the Kerr solution and you add linearized perturbations, which is something that you'd want to do for any solution that you get in GR. In particular, if you're people like Press and Tikosky, you want to study if the solution is actually stable. So you add fluctuations of, let's say, pure gravity. So you add graviton fluctuations, or maybe you add electromagnetic fluctuations or scalar fluctuations, and you get essentially the Tikosky equation, which is a radiation equation in the Kerr spacetime. And if you're very strong, you can actually try and solve this equation, which is, if you've ever dealt with the Kerr solution, pretty horrific. And you find something pretty amazing, which is that you actually get amplification for a particular set of modes that satisfy what's known as the super radiance condition, which I'll mention later. So what this means is that I can send in some classical radiation from infinity in some prepared angular momentum state, and it will scatter off of the black hole, and the scattered amplitude will be larger than the incoming amplitude. So people were very excited about this. This is a way to extract energy from black holes, which, if you're talking about astrophysical black holes, even if you extract a tiny portion of their mass, is an incredible amount of energy. Right, so astrophysicists were interested in it. It's an interesting thing theoretically, and it seems that it's a very particular and very special thing having to do with the Kerr solution. Another way that you can sap energy from a black hole is something that's known as the Penrose process, which I'll describe in a moment. And this is often, you know, if you read a lot of review articles, you'll hear very vague phrases like super radiance is the Penrose process for waves, or something along those lines. And I'll argue here that I actually think that this is not the correct type of statement. Yeah?
It's also true for a solution which has two horizons, horizon or stroke, you get super radiance.
Yeah, and I'm not actually, sorry, when I mean care, I don't mean that Kerr is the only black hole solution which will give you super radiance. What I'm going to argue eventually is just that basically anything that's rotating will give you super radiance. And so Kerr is in particular not so special. So yes, that is true that Reisner-Norsum will also give you that. But to go back to this, there's this sense in the literature that we should think about super radiance as the Penrose process. And the Penrose process, when you study it, is really an effect which happens at a very UV scale, meaning I think about it as a particle coming in. For instance, here, I have a particle that's coming in. Maybe it decays, and I can organize its momentum so that at any given little local patch here. I can satisfy all the conservation equations. And what I can see is I can see that I can get a particle coming out with more energy than the initial particle was coming in. And so from the perspective of the black hole, you know, this is, after all, a particle, right? It's something whose scale is much, much smaller than the typical horizon size. So this is the cartoon of the Penrose process, and there's much fancier versions where you can do very crafty things to try and get slightly more energy. But this is one way that you can extract energy from a black hole, in particular a spinning black hole. And the spin is crucial for this effect, right? Whereas rotational superradiance is very different. And often what's going on is that you're thinking about scattering a wave whose wavelength is much larger than the size of the black hole. Because if the wavelength of the radiation was much, much smaller than the black hole, you'd really just be in the geometric optics limit. And it would be very difficult to extract energy from the black hole. I mean, if it's comparable to the black hole, we know that you can actually solve the Tarkovsky equations. You can see that maybe you can get maximal superradiance. But I guess my point is, if you have a 10-kilometer black hole and you have optical photons, you're really not in any sort of good wave scattering regime. You really should just be considering geometrical optics. So when you consider this phenomenon, you're really thinking about a very different set of scales. In particular, and what I want to focus on, is the regime where the wavelength of this radiation is much larger than the Schwarzschild horizon, or the Schwarzschild radius, or any scale that describes this object here. Okay, and so you're interested in sending in something from infinity, and if A is less than zero, you get some sort of absorption, but you can find by solving the Tarkovsky equations that you can actually get A greater than zero, and this is amplification and this is superradiance. Okay. So,
To be fair, when people say it's wave version of Penrose process, mostly what they mean that Penrose showed that it's possible to extract energy from rotating black hole. So I think that's really, and this
it's
is.
Not mean, they're not saying it's a continuous limit of the other, they're just saying it's analogous.
Well, but I mean, but then I don't think that it has very much content.
No, there is, because well, derive it from just.
Well, let me put it this way. The Penrose process crucially relies on the ergo region. And I'm going to argue here that you don't need an ergo region, right? And we know this from, you know, not to sort of, you know, ruin the punchline, but as Zeldovich taught us, right, you can do super radiance for a conducting cylinder.
But you can derive from that both things, right? So,
can you have an inelastic photon, for example, for a high energy photon, a nonlinear process where a high energy photon splits in two, and then one falls in on the cylinder and another escapes? That would be the analog of the Penrose process for this.
And it would be crucial that it was like a nonlinear medium?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had, in your limit where the wavelength is short, and the geometrical optics could not enter that as being able to talk about it, really is a Penrose process.
Yeah.
Well, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that In that limit, you're relying on the fact that I have some mechanism for the particle to decay into multiple particles.
No, but here, for the it's true. But here, I mean, I think the incoming condition to the horizon, it's like it's negative energy state.
But also, then these are technicalities. Because I mean, the stunning thing about this process was that I'm going to extract energy from black holes. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
That
so
was really surprising.
So if that's your definition, then they fall into the same universality class. I think what I want to emphasize here is that the Penrose process, as usually described, it's crucial that you have an ergo region. And so when you read about rotational superradiance from a wave scattering perspective, the ergo region is highlighted as some kind of
magical
thing which gives you this mechanism. And I just want to make the statement that it's not actually crucial. So maybe this is not the best way to say that, but that's my take-home message. Okay. And now, because I'm interested in this limit where there's this hierarchy of scales, the next thing I want to ask is, can I build some nice effective field theory description of this process so that I can maybe untangle whether this is something very, very special with black holes or a very generic phenomenon? And as I'll argue, it's very generic. Okay, so there's two claims that I want to make from this picture. The first is that Superradiance is a consequence of rotation and dissipation. Secondly, superradiance follows from a tension between absorption and stimulated emission. And so we're going to see, after constructing this effective field theory framework, how these two things can be true. Yeah? In what sense? Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to compute is precisely that instability rate. If I'm looking at something like bound states, or I have some, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm working in ADS or something like that. But it's true that if I have, again, the Kerr solution, I scatter some classical wave, it just scatters once in a wave packet. There's no instability per se. It just gets amplified that single time. Okay.
Why is there a stability? I mean, charged black holes, the reason is stability, and that's exactly unstable, and then it stops growing when you have no more charge. So I don't understand in what sense it's stable. When you reach the charge, the situation. Yeah, but then it's the same here. Similar thing happens here, the end point of the, as let's let Solomon finish, because he'll talk about all of these things. And I think for charged black holes, you can extract similar conclusions about the behavior of the system. So let's have Solomon.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'll say anything in particular about charged black holes here.
Well, charged black holes are lower Planck instant.
Okay.
Too much charge, electric.
Yeah, but I mean.
So it's only a mathematical model, not a physical.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's a good reason why we're probably not going to consider about it. Yeah. So we won't worry. We won't worry about that case. Okay, and as promised, I think I want to also touch on why we're interested in this problem now. So one group, one part of the community, I think, is interested in superradiance again, in part because if you just have a single classical wave and it scatters off the black hole and it takes a little bit of the rotational energy out of the black hole, that's nice, but it's not necessarily such a big deal. One thing that you want to do is you want to orchestrate a situation where you can repeatedly scatter this wave off of the black hole. And one way you can do this is in a very contrived way by building some kind of spherical mirror or something, which is, this is exactly the sort of notorious black hole bomb. But another way is you can actually provide some kind of boundary. For instance, if you have ADS and you have a black hole in the center, and this boundary will allow radiation to reach the boundary and reflect in finite time. And so you can rescatter and you can see things like, for certain sizes of the black hole, you can have instability or not. People are basically interested in these systems, and so they're thinking about superradiance again. I think for this audience, maybe the more relevant application is actually thinking about very light, light particles in beyond the standard model physics. And in particular, they can interact with rotating black holes, and there can maybe even be observational signatures. And so here's some papers from many people in the room. Most of the authors, actually, right?
Actually, that's all of
really? Everybody?
No, John.
Yeah.
John
see, yeah. Okay. Here. Yeah. But I mean, we have at least five, right? So this is as good a reason as any to develop a good calculational framework. I think this is definitely an exciting direction. And what's great is in this case, what performs the role of the mirror is just the mass of this particle, because basically it allows the particle to become bound to the black hole. And so crudely speaking, its Compton wavelength gives some typical size for rescattering off of the black hole. Okay, so now I want to take a slight deviation, and I want to talk about how you would build an effective field theory for spinning objects. And by spinning objects, I want to think of them as being near point-like, because the hierarchy of scales that I have in mind is that these are basically point-like sources interacting with long wavelength radiation. So we want a theory whose degrees of freedom are the position of this point-like object, and then also some set of Euler angles. Now, making this theory Lorentz invariant just by hand turns out to actually be a very subtle and kind of complicated process. People have been thinking about it for maybe 40 plus years, often under the name of, you know, studying the relativistic top. But it turns out that doing so is a lot more subtle than just doing the usual relativistic point particle that we learn about, you know, in freshman physics class. And so I'm going to describe a way which is kind of a foolproof crank that will allow you to just generate the right theory that will give you something which is nice and Lorentz invariant, although secretly so. And yeah, that goes under the name of this coset construction for spontaneous symmetry breaking of spacetime symmetries. And if you want more details, because I'm going to kind of rapidly go through this section, you can find them in this paper from a couple years ago. OK, so quickly an observation. Right, as we know, as Einstein tells us, we know that things are Poincaré invariant, but things are not. Right. So in particular, this wonderful table right here, even though we know QED is Lorentz invariant, it certainly has a preferred reference frame. Right. And so what this means is that the quantum state of this table spontaneously breaks these spacetime symmetries. Right. And so from a particle physics perspective, this is not such an unusual set of words, right? We like to think about this in terms of lots of various spontaneous breaking of gauge theories and stuff like that. But let me now run through this simple example of the usual point particle, which we know how to deal with relativistically, so there's no mystery here, right? Here's a point particle just sitting at rest. Here's its unbroken symmetries. Here's its spontaneously broken symmetries, right? If I had some additional fluctuations, I could write down its general sort of deviation in terms of these variables here. And what I'd have to make sure I was doing was always obeying this usual four velocity constraint of the point particle. And I could write this nice Lorentz invariant action, which I write down just by thinking really hard. And I can expand it around a slow moving particle. Here's our usual rest mass term, here's the kinetic term, and you'll have all the special relativistic corrections. So no mystery, this is stuff you all know. And the key aspect here is that this is something which you just think hard about and you say, oh, it must be the case that this is the action for a relativistic point particle with no orientational degrees of freedom. I was just too excited. Oh my, oh, terrible. You saw everything. I might as well start over. No, okay. So the question is, how could we just immediately write down this without having to first have some nice fully relativistic system? Right? This is something which we desire because unlike the point particle case where we can think in terms of x mu, when we have our three Euler angles and our, even if we also have x mu for the position, the three Euler angles make it very difficult to come up with a nice Lorentz invariant system. So this is the goal for the point particle. And let's see if we can do that. OK. And we learned back in the 70s that there actually is a way to use tools which were already developed for spontaneous symmetry breaking of internal symmetries and use them to generate these sort of goldstones for these spacetime symmetries. So I flashed this slide simply to show you that it's not so easy. And there's actually quite a lot of subtleties, unlike the internal symmetry case. And so here's just a set of kind of recent papers. You know, some are older, some are more recent, about thinking about how to do this problem systematically for different kinds of systems. And so one of the take-home messages is that it turns out not to be so uniquely defined as the case for internal symmetries. So here's kind of the Cliff Notes version of how that story goes. And is very similar to that of the usual CCWZ case. So what we do is we identify our symmetry breaking pattern, where G is the full group, H is the unbroken group. So we're breaking G down to H. And what you want to do is you want some algebraic tools which basically build these things, which I will call covariant derivatives of our Goldstones. But they're basically just big mathematical objects that transform in a way that makes our life easy. Right? So under some element of the full group G, they transform in some nice linear representation of an element of the unbroken group H. So in particular, if there is no unbroken group H, these things will just transform trivially. And so they kind of are bundling all of our difficulty together in little building blocks which we can use. Now, this is a particular a step which is particular only to the space-time symmetry case, which is that sometimes you have more Goldstones than you actually have real degrees of freedom. We can think about that from the perspective of the point particle, because the point particle, not only did it break boosts, but it also broke translation. So for instance, this guy's at rest, and it's also sitting there, as opposed to here, right? And so you would naively say that it has six Goldstones for the six broken symmetries, or the six generators, and instead it just has three. And so what's really going on is it turns out that the boosts are, of course, related to derivatives of translations. In essence, and there's lots of different examples that you can use to see this. One thing that's interesting is that there, for a given symmetry breaking pattern, you can come up with different sort of UV completions, if you will, meaning you know explicitly the quantum state which is doing the breaking. And in one of them, you can see that this is obviously a redundant degree of freedom, and in another, it turns out to just be a gap degree of freedom. Yeah. So if you allow yourself to always work at the lowest possible energies, then you can always use these kinds of constraints to eliminate some of your Goldstones. Okay. And finally, now that you have these nice objects, some of which turn out to be constraints, you can build a nice Lagrangian out of these objects, which transforms under the full group G, but your Goldstones, of course, transform nonlinearly. And so in some sense, what you've done is you've kind of cheated. And instead of just sort of thinking hard and writing down an obviously Lorentz invariant answer, you've built some structure which generates these things for you. So in essence, this is really what we have. We have a big machine that we can turn the crank, and we can get precisely what we want. Now, there's one missing ingredient, which will be crucial for the rest of this talk, which is how I couple some external field to this system. So in particular, because I'm interested in this world line effective theory of this rotating object, what I need to do is I need to couple some bulk Lorentz invariant field, like the graviton or the photon or some scalar, to this world line. And essentially, all I have to do is I have to take the inverse of this exponential of my Goldstones contracted with all my my broken generators, and just act on my Lorentz invariant field. So for instance, if I was thinking about gravity, where R is the curvature tensor, I'd act with these generators, so the generators of rotation and boost, and I would create this object R tilde, which transforms nicely under my symmetry group, right? So this looks a little formal now, but it will basically be the key ingredient that allows us to get super radiance. Yes?
If you take a vector field, it's not zero.
Mm-hmm.
You break SO3, comma 1, compared to O3.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an example right there.
Yeah.
This is concluded in the...
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a classic example.
Yeah, exactly. So you can use all of this stuff for that system.
Three generators, but not three.
Exactly. And so Yeah, this formalism, all you have to know is what that symmetry breaking pattern is. You don't even need to know that it's some vector field with some expectation value. Right, you just given the symmetry breaking pattern, you generate the generic theory for the fluctuations. So, as promised, let's talk about the spinning object. So this is the symmetry breaking pattern. Now, I want a spinning object which is spherically symmetric, right? That by saying it's spherically symmetric, that doesn't mean that it doesn't break space-time rotations, because it does. Essentially the way to think about it is thinking of it as, you know, some larger material body where I almost like label the internal coordinates. And so the thing that's unbroken is really a combination of some internal transformation of those internal coordinates and the space-time rotation. And so it's the diagonal combination of these things which is unbroken for, let's say, a spherical object. If I just had some random object which had no internal symmetry, then I would just break the rotations in that's the end of it.
And also for points like particles, there would be
no. Yeah, a point like particles is interesting because, you know, from my perspective, there's no way you can take a real object and get it to just be a point without the rotational degrees of freedom, because the rotational degrees of freedom are gapless. So they're always kind of there. I think the point like particle from, you know, just.
There's no second group there. Well, it's a physical,
well,
you can take a
solid. Oh, sure, yeah,
well,
yeah, yeah.
A solid one, right?
Yeah, well,
point like, but
yeah, the interesting thing about the, yeah, exactly, a soliton's a good example, yeah. So there, you don't have any, you would have an unbroken part, which is just Jij,
right?
Right? And here, instead of there being any broken rotations, you just have broken boost. Yeah, so this is my symmetry breaking pattern. And I turn this crank, which you can find more details in that paper before. And here we've included interactions with gravity because that's subtle and is different than other kinds of Poincaré fields because it's the gauge group associated with Poincaré as opposed to just some U1. And this is what the action looks like. So the building blocks which I have are these covariant derivatives of alpha, which are essentially the Goldstones associated with the generators for space-time rotations. And they take this seemingly complicated form where lambda turns out to be some Lorentz matrix, which is just given by a boost and a rotation. And essentially what this thing is telling you, this matrix, is it's telling you to go to the frame of the object. So boost to that object and then rotate to be in its correct orientation. And so here we have the part which we're accustomed to seeing for the usual point-like particle, which encodes its mass. And this part here, if this thing's SO3 invariant, this will just become the usual moment of inertia tensor and the angular velocities. So this is how you build a Lorentz invariant action secretly for a rotating object. And there's additional terms here. Higher corrections, because since we have some effective field theory, we have some cutoff scale, so on and so forth. And we can talk about those in a little more detail in a moment. So what are we missing? Well, unfortunately for us, we know that dissipation is notoriously important for black holes, since they eat things. And so we need to figure out how to incorporate this in our effective field theory. And so this is something which you don't normally see when you're dealing with effective field theories in a particle physics context. And the reason that is interesting in and of itself. But usually you're thinking of something which you know explicitly, some heavy mass or massive particle, you integrate it out. And here we have something slightly more subtle. So what is dissipation? So dissipation is associated with missing light modes. And what I mean by that is, let's think about how we describe this sort of point-like orientable object, right? I said that we could describe it by just its position and also its orientation. But for something like the Earth, even at very, very, very long wavelengths, there's also this host of additional degrees of freedom which have support even as the frequency goes to zero. And so what I mean by this is, imagine something which has some finite, some gapped degrees of freedom as a counterexample, and I was sending in some radiation of a particular wavelength on this gap degree of freedom. Well, if that frequency, let's say, is high enough, I can excite those gap degrees of freedom, but as soon as I drop below that gap, they just essentially decouple. There's no way for me to excite those things anymore. And this is precisely what dissipation doesn't do, right? Normal friction, like if I'm, you know, modeling something moving across this table, that friction force is there even at infinitely slow speed, right? It doesn't sort of decouple as soon as I go below some rate. And what this...
Sorry, I mean, this is your definition of dissipation. Okay, so there are examples of dissipation which don't behave like that, right?
I guess, yeah, this is my definition of dissipation. What do you have in mind?
I mean, so there are some things like if you have moving through a superfluid, say if you're moving below a certain velocity, it's dragless, but you move above a certain velocity, and it's no longer dragless.
Well, but I mean, you could say the same thing about, you know, like we were talking about, if you have something which is coupled to some massive particle, and its internal frequencies are below the frequency, that mass, right? It's not, it doesn't radiate that particle, but as soon as it speeds up, then it radiates that particle. So I would say.
The definition of a particular kind of dissipation you're interested in.
Yeah, yeah, and. But the key here is this idea that we have support over frequencies which go to zero. And so from the effective field theory point of view, the usual picture is that we have some, you know, energy scale, and it's always kind of clear what this axis is supposed to be, but you have these various sorts of regimes, and you're trying to write down your theory at various energy scales, and maybe there's some mass. And when I go below this mass, I can integrate, you know, all of this stuff out, right? And the idea is that when you're at some particular scale, you have to keep all degrees of freedom which have masses of that scale and below. And so we have Goldstones, which are massless, so these rotational degrees of freedom and these translational degrees of freedom. But we also apparently have this host of infinite, also massless degrees of freedom. And somehow we haven't incorporated those things.
So is your picture that you have two scales, one of which was the size of the object, and one of which was the spacing of levels in the object. And you're saying that you're in a regime where the size is so small that you've integrated out the size, but you still can see the spacing between the states are all localized on the object?
Yes.
And so those are your size, or all these?
Yeah, so for instance, if I go back, well, let me see. Here we go. So the higher order terms here are controlled by things like I've essentially integrated out the gapped modes of the object. So for instance, if I have a material body, it also has normal modes, right? Like it's going to have some octopal mode and other such vibrational modes. Right, and these things are going to be given by a definite frequency. And so when I work at frequencies below that, those things can be integrated out, and they will just renormalize the coefficients for higher order terms, which basically tell me things like if I rotate the object will actually slightly distort. But it will go, it's distort in an off-shell kind of way.
So you're dissipating a regime where that frequency is actually inside your cutoff, so you've got all these things.
Yeah.
You're going to keep all those things.
Yeah.
Yes,
exactly. So you have some picture where the you have some tower of vibrational modes, right? So they just go up like this, and you're below all of those, but there's sort of this sea of these dissipative objects. And you know, if you think about why these such things should exist, so for the Earth, for instance, you'd say, well, obviously the lowest mode is given by, you know, whatever quadrupole oscillation that is, and it has some frequency of, I don't know, 12 hours. But we know that the actual Earth has slower modes than that because I can dissipate at much, much lower frequencies, right? And so So even though you have this like natural scale set by the size of the object and various things like the sound travel time, there are these other things, which probably are there because if you actually looked at the atomic physics, there'd be some kind of fine tuning between two different things so that, you know, they almost exactly canceled, so the difference was very small. Yeah, but the Bohr, I think the point is that the Bohr atom doesn't have any of these modes because really there's nothing else there.
You could have been working in a regime where you would integrate out the Bohr radius, but you still can resolve the space between the ground state and the connected state.
Yeah, we can add those things in if we wanted to. So for instance, you can put those back into the theory by essentially adding some world line degree of freedom that is in some representation of the unbroken group. So the quadrupole, let's say, and it just has some particular mass. So those are allowed terms to add. Yeah?
So what are examples of these Cs, psi's?
Well, I guess they would be, so if I took the proper Earth and all of its many, many, many degrees of freedom, right, given by, you know, 6n, the number of atoms, plus some, right, when I integrate all of it out and write it as just the single location plus its orientation plus some finite set of modes, I've gotten rid of a lot of degrees of freedom. And the claim is that in doing so, not all of those were actually above the scale which you were working.
Part of what's confusing is that there's this scales of momentum and scales of energy, right? And I think what you're relying on is the fact that they're different and that the energy is more finely spaced.
Yeah, all of these are from, so now that we're at this world line picture, they're just purely in energy spacing, that's right.
Can I ask though something that I'm very confused about what you say, which I think is related to what
they look the same. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Same breakers.
Yeah, exactly. No, see, you're assuming that participation is associated with the Gabriel's theory, right? That you always
That's right.
But I can imagine from a physical perspective, there's always going from let's say an atom.
Yeah.
To absorb photons, but it can absorb them in a very discrete.
That's
way.
Right.
So going from the Earth to from the atom to the Earth.
Yes.
There are situations where you're making assumptions about the properties of the object that does the absorption.
That's right. Yeah.
So for a black hole, I think it's a fair assumption to make. I don't know if it's all for any object would be the same. I guess for big enough object, it must be true.
Yeah, I think that's...
Not necessarily, but I mean, co-absorption is saying that you're having some long wavelength modes matched to a frequency of the mode inside, like matched to one of the sort of large oscillation modes of the object.
Those guys we can add in by hand.
But there could be discrete modes, right? There is something to do with the size of the object that you. This picture assumes that you have the available number of degrees of freedom. Is almost infinite or continuous, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely an assumption about what these.
This object that does the absorption is.
Exactly.
Okay.
But I think as a physical assumption, yeah.
For sure applies.
But from the EFT perspective, there's not much difference from a black hole and a neutron star in terms of absorbing long wavelength radiation.
That I would imagine that's true, but what would happen to your absorption if you were assuming that in fact there's a minimum energy that can be absorbed? So instead of going all the way to zero.
Yeah. Then it would disappear. That's right. There would be no dissipation.
No, but then it's not. Somehow it's confusing then, because I can still absorb photons by atoms. So if I send my laser beam.
Yeah.
With a bunch of atoms, just the gas. So there's
no. But you're working energies that are
way smaller than that. Yeah.
Infinitely soft photons. So the modes that you can excite that are quantized, you can include in this higher derivative. Below the lowest quantized energy, may not be
there. So yeah. Then what the question is, you're saying that they appear that, like non-absorbent at that point. There's going to be a regime where the object appears as like...
Yeah, precisely. So for instance, the atom, it has some, lowest level.
Yeah,
and then if you try and shine longer wavelength light on it?
Yeah, it won't, nothing will
exactly
happen. No, so you're saying that if you're looking at energies above the minimum energy of the object,
yes,
then you would see that you have modes where you can excite and absorb, right?
Yes.
So would that capture that picture, yeah, what you're talking about?
Yeah, okay, yeah, provided that it's dense enough, meaning
yeah.
I don't want the density of states to be some set of very peaked values.
No.
Okay. And so I think the physical claim is that in practice, dissipative objects like the moon actually behave like this.
Apart from this issue of long wavelength sort of sound loads the whole object, which is not necessarily true.
You just work below. You work below them.
Yeah.
Okay. So dissipation is important.
Is there any assumption somewhere that the internal motion of this object that is small, that is somehow slow? In the example that Cliff gave, the Bohr radius, inverse Bohr radius, is different from the energy spacing because the motion inside an atom, it has V over C much smaller.
Sure,
than
yeah.
Alpha, right?
Yeah.
If I go to Z alpha order one, that's no longer true, right? So the momentum scale and the energy scale becomes very similar.
Yeah, I mean here.
If you take point light, but you still insist on resolving the energy scales.
Yeah.
Do we make any implicit assumption that the motion inside an object is non-relativistic?
Possibly, but I also don't see why you couldn't have some complicated bound system, which, you know.
Splittings rather than energy absolute levels.
Yeah,
so I think
yeah.
Splittings will, what I'm trying to say, that in large Z atom, the momentum scale for the Bohr radius is comparable to the energy space. Because it all goes in
the for a system like an atom.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly what the answer is, but in principle, the objects which we, I mean, a black hole is a good example. I mean, who knows how to describe these things? But you know, choose your favorite strange model of what these exact degrees of freedom are. You know, string states on the horizon or whatever. Okay, so now that we sort of know that these things are there, or at least we postulate that they're there, and we want to see if we can demonstrate that the physics is correct. How do we incorporate them? Well, we incorporate them by just adding operators, which consist of these degrees of freedom in ways which we have no idea, but are basically placeholders for these effects. And we classify these operators and how they transform under the unbroken group. And then we just couple them to our other degrees of freedom through any possible means. So it's the usual effective field theory method. You have things, you just have to build all available couplings. So let me write down what the case is for the gravitational case, just because I can actually point to the individual terms and they'll have nice physical consequences. So this is the true action, which is given by some Lagrangian of all these things. The tildes mean that they transform in the unbroken group. And there's the angular velocity of this rotational object. There's, maybe these psi's are actually awkward notation. This is supposed to be some external Lorentz field, like in this case, the graviton. These are covariant derivatives, which I can also build with this coset construction. And these are these dissipative operators, which I don't know much about. But what I'll effectively do is I'll do some kind of correlation function matching, which will give me the physical data which allows me to make predictions. Okay, so here's the action. Okay, here's our point, you know, our mass term. This is our usual kinetic term. This is the term I was telling you about, which if it spins fast, the object slightly distorts and builds a non-spherically symmetric moment of inertia. This is a term which couples C as the Weyl tensor. It tells us about how if I apply some external gravitational field, the object distorts and also changes its moment of inertia. This is, you know, a quadrupole-induced quadrupole coupling. This is the magnetic quadrupole-induced quadrupole coupling. And here we have these operators, which basically are responsible for things like the, if I send a single photon into this spinning object, it's this operator which will eat up electric parity, electromagnetic waves, and this one will eat up magnetic parity, electromagnetic waves. And so you can actually compute the cross-section using this Lagrangian and doing some matching for the correlation functions of these operators. Yeah?
Morally, that sounds very similar to hydrodynamic story, but what is the difference? Because there, kind of, we have good evidence that somehow this formalism doesn't capture everything, and one should really use this two-time Keldysh formalism.
So we would want to use the two-time Keldysh formalism once we integrate out these guys. So this is the step before you integrate out these degrees of freedom, and so then you need the Keldysh formalism
to. Well, I think that in hydrodynamics, it's really one needs. It's even before integrating out, it's just this formalism doesn't, like, you know.
Yeah, certainly.
Right?
So, yeah, that's right.
So it's not just about integrating out these guys, in the but it's really just this formalism is not adequate. So,
yeah. So I mean, that's...
What's the difference? Why it doesn't work in Hydra and works here?
I don't know. I think part of the confusion is why it fails in Hydra, which I think is more the it's the same question, but I think that's actually the more surprising thing. And essentially what I'll do is I'll argue that this actually gives us all the right phenomena. So for instance, what Sergey is talking about is essentially if you try and run the same program for hydrodynamics, you actually find that it's very difficult to get dissipation at nonlinear order,
But given that. Okay, we don't understand why it fails there. Are you not scared that also here it may be missing something?
Yeah, it could be possible. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing I like about this is it seems physically motivated. I think also another way to put it is that you can recover answers which you know should be there, which is precisely the problem for hydrodynamics. So the difficulty with hydrodynamics is you can't even write down the right Navier-Stokes equations, right, which are just the usual equations of motion for a dissipative fluid. But here, I can use this and then integrate out using NN, and I can get the right equations for things like tidal locking, which will give me, you know, intertidal dynamics between two rotating point-like bodies. I mean, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess there's always some.
But also there, it produces some effects. So one would like to know that.
Yeah, but just, yeah.
Some effects here.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I'll do some explicit computations later, which will show how that happens. But from the equations of motion perspective, you can think of it as doing the path integral in two stages. So you want to first do the path integral over these hidden degrees of freedom, and that will give you some effective action, which you can then vary and get the correct equations of motion. And so the things which will live inside that effective action are just going to be correlation functions of these operators. And as I'll argue later, these correlation functions take a particularly simple form precisely because they are dissipative in nature. In particular, very roughly speaking, what we'll find is we'll find things like the correlation functions of two O's goes like a number times a single power of frequency in momentum space. I mean, the right particular combination of this correlation function. But so what this will allow you to do is it'll allow you to get this single derivative that you really want when you're trying to get dissipative effects.
Is the idea that I hit this and I have a crack?
There's some physical assumptions about the nature of these operators, but the only thing that you really have to do, which fixes this form plus O omega cubed, the outside thing that you have to input is just the value of this constant. So you can do some matching computation in some way, And now that you know this constant, you can go off and do some other experiments, right? Which is basically just, you know, it's an effective theory. It can't tell you everything, right? And so you need some initial data, like what exactly is the spinning object? Is it a black hole? Is it a neutron star? Depending on which one it is, this constant will be different. But the nature of dissipation in the system will be the same. Sorry, say it again? Yeah, okay, so that's a little bit of a technicality, but basically the point is any traces of Riemann, you can just field redefine away, so they don't have any physical significance. You can just field redefine them and you renormalize your higher order terms.
So if I had other fields besides
the metric, then I might have gotten that. Yeah, that's right, That's exactly right. Okay. So reminder that these are the two claims, and let's see how this is borne out. So let's look at an absorption of a single quanta on our rotating dissipative object. So we really want to just compute this, where this is some initial state of the black hole in this case. This is some final state. We don't really care about what this final state is because we can't really tell the difference between one black hole and another. So we're going to try and sum over all these final states. And S, of course, is just this time-ordered product of the interaction Hamiltonian. So this is nothing surprising. This is just usual quantum mechanics. And there we go. And so we're going to choose, for the moment, our interaction Hamiltonian to be this. There's, of course, a big infinite tower of them, and I'll talk about the different kinds of interactions in a moment. But let's focus on this one for a moment. So we have a single derivative, and because this external field has to be dressed with this Lorentz matrix, it also comes with some rotation, right? So here I'm considering a very simple system where the object is just sitting there, it's not boosted in any crazy way, and it's just rotating. So the only part of the Lorentz matrix left is this rotation, and this is my coupling here. And so now we can turn the crank and we can do things to linear order. We compute this probability. Like I said, we're going to discuss other types of interactions later, and this looks like one which may be leading, so maybe we should have been discussing that, but hold on to that question for a moment. And as you can see, when you do this computation, you get some correlation function of these operators. So this goes back to your point, Cliff, is that when you're actually doing these computations, this is how they show up, and so later we're going to try and figure out what this capital delta is. And then we have to do some work to now compute this object, but this is just straightforward quantum mechanics, just in this angular momentum basis of L and M. You turn the crank a little bit. One key aspect is that when you have the rotation matrix and it contracts with this vector, which comes out of here, you pick up this factor of e to the I omega t, where capital omega is the angular velocity. Okay, so now the numerator looks like this, which means the probability for absorption is given by this, where again, delta is related to the correlation function of these dissipative operators. Okay. And this thing's just positive. You can prove that it's positive, which makes sense because you'd like to have absorption of a quanta be a positive quantity since we're dealing with squares. Now we can compute the emission of a single quanta. Again, we're going to be agnostic about the final state. And the only thing that has really changed is some slight order here. And so what we find is we find that emission rate looks exactly like the absorption rate with these things switched. And as you can see, there's this combination of omega and m omega, which those who are well versed in super radiance will recognize immediately. This is also a positive quantity. Now let's consider super radiant scattering of when we fix ourselves to L equal 1, because as you can see here, this probability is only non-zero when L equals 1. Yeah?
Sorry, can I ask quickly?
Yeah.
This particular event, can this happen if the field is in a vacuum state even?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting effect called vacuum friction. So if I have a rotating conducting cylinder of finite conductivity, it will actually spontaneously emit, let's say, photons in a preferred angular momentum state and slow down. Yeah. So I'm going to send in some beam of particles. And there's two effects. There's absorption, and then there's stimulated emission. And I put these two things together. And what do I find? I find the difference between these two things is given by this quantity, where rho is the density of states. And the density of states is a nice kind of physical interpretation of what these correlation functions are doing. And in particular, I can show that just by general properties of densities of states, that they it's an odd function of the argument. And so it goes like omega to some odd power. And it is positive for positive arguments. So in particular, we can show that when you satisfy these super radiant conditions, you actually have amplification. So for instance, when this is satisfied, your outgoing radiation is larger than your incoming radiation. So this is super radiance very generally. We can talk about further moments. Remember, the initial coupling was just a single derivative on the scalar with a single rotation matrix. Let's add more derivatives. What happens? Well, basically, it allows us to couple with higher powers of the angular momentum, higher L's. And that was why I didn't consider just the single scalar phi, because super radiance doesn't happen when there's no angular momentum. So it's a very similar story. You can compute things. You can also use higher spin fields. Same kind of things are going on. You just turn the crank. And now let's actually add in some physical input. Goes back to Cliff's question. So this density of states for dissipative type operators should emit a low frequency expansion, since we're working at very small frequencies. And as we said, generic properties of densities of states means that it has to be odd, so it starts like omega, and gamma has to be a positive function. And so now we can extract this from some sort of matching procedure, and we can basically write down whatever else we want. So in particular, we can compute some observables and match them to what we know about Schwarzschild. And we find that gamma is actually equal to that sort of special collection of numbers. And we now have a prediction, which is that the super radiant rate for massive scalars for a slowly rotating black hole is given by this. And that actually matches what is known in the literature, which is a good check that this formalism is making sense. And maybe Sergei gives us a little bit of confidence that we can capture some of the relevant physics. OK, so now finally, let's talk about bound states for just a couple minutes before you go. So if we have massive particles, this mass can form a mirror and allow the particle to repeatedly scatter off the black hole. And so what we want is we want the Compton wavelength to be much larger than the Schwarzschild radius if we're interested in compact object like a neutron star black hole. And if we want it to be, let's say, 10 times larger, this gives you a mass range mu, which has to be less than this 10 to the minus 22 electron volts, which is also an interesting number for kinds of fuzzy dark matter models. And in this regime, you can really think of this massive particle scattering off this black hole as really just a gravitational atom. And by atom, I mean it in the exact analogy way, meaning that you're going to be solving the same wave equations as you would if you were doing Griffith's quantum mechanics. So in particular, we can write our quantum operator as having some bound state contribution plus the wave solutions. And we can solve these. And we find that the radial part solves the usual Schrodinger equation for the hydrogen atom, where now the fine structure constant is replaced by a gravitational fine structure constant given by gm mu. And so the energy of each one of these states is given by this expression, where mu is again the mass, so there's a rest mass contribution. Now, we can turn the same crank as we did for the scattering case, only now we're thinking, awkward text, But we can basically consider a single state being absorbed by the black hole. And I will kind of go through this quickly, but essentially the point is that when you're doing this computation, just as before, you see this correlation function show up, and then you also see derivatives on the wave function of the quantum wave function of this scalar particle. And then this thing, when you actually plug in what those solutions are, you get this expression for the timescale for absorption and the timescale for emission. And what we can do is we can put these two things together, and then we can get a super radiant instability for this massive mode. And what's interesting is now we can use the information that we gleaned from the scattering case, we can use that for the bound state case, because those operators are precisely the same ones as before. And so in particular, their density of states is the same. And so we can extract that information, and we can get the time scale for super radiant instability of a massive particle around a rotating black hole, and we get the exact right coefficients. So let me conclude here with a couple comments about things that could happen in the future that I think are fairly exciting. So this was sort of just the first initial steps that this program is working. One thing we spent a lot of time thinking about and are still trying to work through is trying to do the actual much more relevant case of massive vectors, and relevant from the perspective of if you have a massive vector in Kerr spacetime, you can't actually solve the wave equation. And so it's much more useful to have some kind of analytic handle, whereas the massive scalar, you can just be strong and do it. And what you find is you find an enhanced instability rate. And we want to see if we can understand that process a little better. We can also use this effective field theory method to slowly turn on higher order terms. So for instance, things like post-Newtonian corrections, various kinds of mode mixing from spin-orbit coupling, things like that.
Can I ask you, spin-orbit coupling goes is a higher order than alpha, right?
Yeah.
And you just said that alpha is small, right?
Yeah.
But
it's also tunable, meaning depending on the mass of this particle and the size of the black hole, alpha can scale. Yeah, that's right. So for the purposes of those computations, I was taking the leading alpha effect.
Right.
Yeah. And so for instance, it's well known that the instability rate is nearly maximal when you have when you have fairly large alphas and very rapid spins. And so we want to kind of approach that as best we can. And
how do you check how well you can approach it for the scalar case?
Yeah, not in detail, to be perfectly honest. It's something which needs to be done, yeah.
But it should be possible for you to do large alpha as well, right?
Yeah.
Because there should be something replacing the alpha, because when alpha gets larger than 1/2, say, it's a different level because it becomes super radiant, and probably it's alpha over n, there should be some replacement.
Oh, I see, yeah. Because sort of the innermost mode is just completely swallowed.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's not super radiant anymore.
Okay. Yeah.
It's larger L mode becomes.
Yeah.
L mode becomes super radiant.
I see.
Effectively, it should be that something like alpha over L.
I see.
Is the actual parameter.
Yeah. I mean, it could be possible. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that could definitely be the case.
The other thing is, I mean, have you thought about neutron stars at all?
We were talking about them yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, and so that's one of the should be here. Yeah. General objects.
Okay.
I was waiting. Yeah. Speaking of neutron stars. Yeah. So I mean, what's nice about these methods, of course, is that they apply to more generic objects.
That's awesome. So you can start from a microphysical coupling, like.
Presumably, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but there's reason to believe that maybe neutron stars are tricky for microphysics reasons, but.
You don't expect these modes to couple as strongly because you don't just have a coupling that depends
couple of really low momentum modes to fermions, but specifically it's fermions and a neutron star, which are highly degenerate and have a hard time absorbing low momentum modes.
Well, can you have things that, because you have many, can you have levels that are just, you excite things around the fermion surface, and these are the things you can
I hope
also...
so, yes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right, it is just a suppression in the end. There is still, a fraction.
Yeah, there's still a fraction. But you also have the protons and the electrons, right?
Yeah, so the electrons are going to be the nice ones. The protons are going to give you this 1 over mass suppression. Well, you have like a 1 over mass suppression for something like confident absorption, you can think that as.
Okay.
So yeah, electrons move in.
Yeah.
From a purely practical empirical point of view, what we see now is from LIGO. Gravitational radiation, we know the fraction of what comes out. It's not all that big. So, happens if you estimate super radiance for that object, for those objects? What are those events?
Well, so we.
You have a phone. I mean, it must be tiny. How are we ever going to measure this?
Oh, my God.
So there's a couple things in there. So, those objects, I mean, you mean the gravitational radiation from the final... Yeah, so gravitational superradiance is not that great of a way to measure superradiance, which is precisely why these bound states are interesting. I mean, there's better experts in the room to maybe answer this question, but I think one thing you would like is that if there were these light particles, what you could see is with a lot of data, you could see some sort of spin distributions, and you would see some suppression for, let's say, large spins.
What about Sagittarius A star?
Well, it's also
the mass is enormous.
Yeah, exactly. And so, if you had a particular mass, if you had like, let's say, 10^-22 eV, that object wouldn't be, you know, that's much smaller than Sagittarius A star. And so there's no super radiance there. So it probably, so once you fix that mass, you fix the population of black holes that you're interested in. So it'd be very possible to avoid, let's say, supermassive black hole type measurements, but nevertheless have an interesting spin population from LIGO. So yeah, it's actually, I think, much more observable than the kind of ideas people had 30 years ago about super radiance, where they were trying to think of things like various sorts of, it's not the right word, levitating orbits or something. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where somehow you had floating orbits?
Floating orbits, yeah.
Yeah, so various kinds of contrived scenarios where you'd be sending in electromagnetic or gravitational radiation, and that would be super radiating and then back reacting on the particle, which was somehow generating that. So people are trying to mess around with it, but I actually think these bound state scenarios are probably the most exciting, yeah. And you know, even if you just want to think about it from the perspective of bounds, if you just want to kill theories, it's still another good thing that you should be thinking about. Well, you say we didn't see it. We calculated it. If you said it, you know, it's a way to show that given some set of couplings, you know, you would expect this, and it's not there. I mean, it's a pretty clean probe as far as astrophysics is concerned. In my perspective. Well, that's what I mean. So it's a lot better than many other things out there. One final point, I just to sort of plug this method again. I actually think that one thing that's nice about it is it's very complementary to more numerical type things, precisely because it's most successful when you have this separation of scales, which means that you oftentimes have very long time scales relative to the horizon crossing time scale. And so I think it's a really nice complement to, you know, if you have really great computers, in some sense you don't need any analytical stuff, or at least that's what you'd think. But this basically gives you a very cheap way to get a handle on something which would otherwise be very costly or difficult. And so I think together they can probably be very successful. All right, anyways, let me stop there. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we had quite a few questions throughout. If anyone has any very urgent ones, but fun one we hear all week.
All week, so, yeah.
Thanks all again.
Thank you. Oh, and I'm just going to leave that.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, this is what happens when you're making slides and you're looking for image. Yeah, exactly.